Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome, and thanks for having us, guys. And Chris, this will be a great conversation. I'm realizing we might have had a script that I was supposed to read to begin this. With that in mind, even better than me introducing Chris and telling you about his background.
Yeah.
I'm going to have you introduce yourself.
Yeah, happy to.
Tell us more about how you got to where you are.
Yeah, so happy to. So thanks, everyone, for coming. And thanks for, we rescheduled it. I got sick on the book tour. And so we're doing it over. So just briefly, I've spent my whole career working on the internet. And I started off as a software engineer and then became an entrepreneur. I started two companies. The first company was an internet security company, and the second company was a kind of artificial intelligence company, and then started investing in the internet. And now I am sort of full-time working on the internet, on internet startups, and got interested in the area of blockchains about 10 years ago and have been working in that area. The book I wrote is called Read, Write, Own, and it's about the history of the internet with a focus on how the internet went from being an open and decentralized network of the 90s, one where anyone could go and create a website. That website could be something that was creative. It could be a business. It could be a nonprofit. And you were able to build a direct relationship with your audience. And this had to do with the origins of the internet, having come out of government and academia and being designed as an open and sort of democratically controlled system. I was personally very inspired by that architecture. That's why I got into this industry in the 90s. I thought it was, in some ways, you know, I think it was inevitable that once we had computers in the world and sort of everyone had a computer, that we would connect those computers. But it wasn't inevitable that it would be done in this sort of open and democratic way. One could imagine an alternative version of the world where a company like AOL or some other kind of centralized company controlled the internet. And so I thought that was a very powerful thing. I was very excited about it. And then over the last 20 years, the internet has increasingly become controlled by, you know, five or so companies. So Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, et cetera. Those companies now control 95% plus of the internet traffic, of the money that flows through the internet. And I believe that is a bad thing for the world, for creative people, for startups, for just generally for innovation. And so about 10 years ago, I started thinking about ways to kind of correct that. And that's when I led me down this path to get interested in blockchains and sort of new ways to build internet services that would bring us back to a lot of the original ideals of the internet. Since this is a complicated topic, I tried to explain this to lots of people for years, and I found that it was very hard to explain. And so I finally said, I need to write a book.
Is that what brought you to writing the book? Yeah. I thought that was fascinating too. We should get into some of the early internet history, yeah, which I thought was really valuable in this book too. It's not necessarily what you go to the book for, but you kind of get that scene setting. So we'll get to that, but I'd love to get your take on why you wrote the book and who your audience is for this.
Yeah, so I've been working in this area for a long time. And then I was like a lot of people who work in this area, I was very disappointed by some of these, you know, really bad things that happened a couple of years ago. So most prominently, FTX. This is a kind of crypto blockchain exchange that people know about probably, that, you know, that was end up being a fraud and hurt a lot of people. And, you know, I saw it as there's this core technology around blockchains, and then there's sort of two cultures that have embraced it. And there's the culture that I see myself as being part of, which I would, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I believe it's sort of the productive culture. And then there's this other culture who I believe kind of co-opts it and uses it in this kind of nefarious way. And so that happened. I call it casino culture. And that happened, and that was like, whatever, that was 2 years ago and something like that. And at first I was kind of depressed and feeling sorry for myself. And then I was like, you know, maybe I should like sort of half glass full, think of this as an opportunity to go and explain why I see the world so differently than, or, you know, like for me, this is like, I mean, I spent 25 years working on the internet, like, and I, people that know me will tell you, like, this is all I do and all I think about. And like, I'm like, I see the world. It's like, I'm looking at this coffee cup and it's like right here and everyone's telling me it's not here. And I know it's here. And I feel like I see the world a certain way. And I think this is probably why some people, other people write books. You feel this, I felt this compulsion, like
hallucinating.
I'm either hallucinating or crazy, or I see, maybe because of so many years of spending time on this, I see the world a certain way, and I really wanted to explain it. And I was sort of out there podcasting and talking to people and trying to explain it, and you know, and some people understood it, but some didn't. And I just finally kind of realized you need more context, right? You need the sort of background, and there's certain things that just can't be explained outside of the context of a book. I mean, a book is a special thing because it's like you can really get into something in a way you can't in a conversation.
Yeah. And you were a prolific writer before that, and a blogger, I think, as well. A book is absolutely, I think, the right format for this topic. And maybe we could do sort of a distilled version of how we got here to sort of the Web 2 era, which we should also point out, I guess, your firm, Andreessen Horowitz, was kind of an early architect and funder of some of those companies. I actually would love to ask you about that. And, you know, writing this book and having these ideas that would theoretically disrupt, you know, the company, the firm that you work for.
Yeah. So maybe I'll take the last part first. Yeah. So, and that is a common kind of question, right? Is that like me and like, I work with Mark Andreessen and other people who, you know, he created the first popular web browser, and we've all been working on the internet for a long time. And, you know, I think a lot of us, I mean, honestly, like, Did it, even the most like optimistic people, like, I never imagined, let me put it this way, that like a social network that was used by Harvard students would become a $1.2 trillion mega company that controls, like, I don't think most people did. Like, it just got, like, obviously, like, people involved in the internet business invested and worked on companies, and but I don't think in the end, like, you don't, it's not good for, like, we're in the venture capital business, we're investing in startups, we need a dynamic, vibrant, kind of, you know, innovation friendly internet to do our business. And so obviously we want some, you know, some of our companies to succeed, but when they succeed this much, when it's like five companies that control it, the risk is you end up like, you know, the 1970s broadcast TV or radio, or like
broadcast TV.
Well, in this, no, I meant pre CNBC. Yes. Now it's great because it's CNBC, but back in the bad days, you only had NBC, CBS, and ABC on, like, that's why I said broadcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Able real
good analogy. Okay. Like, you make that point in the book too, that like you're at least your source of information pre internet, right? When you have those three, and that's
those three, and you had no, and you, therefore you didn't have like new startup television channels. And so like, that's kind of the, like, I think the internet is a special thing, and it's this vibrant, dynamic thing where, you know, in theory it should be like, for example, there was a, if you go back, and I quote some of this in the book, in the 90s and early 2000 internet, there were all of these idealistic books and, you know, writers who talked about this is going to change the economics of creativity, for example. And so the idea was, like, this author, Kevin Kelly, who's also the co-founder of Wired, has this famous blog post called 1,000 True Fans. And it was written in like 2003 or four or something. And his idea was that, let's take musicians. Like, so musicians prior to the internet, right, the only thing, you had to like sign a label and hit it big and go on and, like, you know, you were either a megastar or you were, you know, doing some other job on the side, right? Like, it was like all or nothing. And the hope of the internet, this 1,000 True Fans, right, this idea was, now that you can build a direct relationship with this audience, unmediated by labels and all the other kinds of people that sit in the middle, that maybe now that can change the economics. And why it's called 1,000 True Fans, because imagine if, like, I'm into, like, some, you know, interesting hobby, cooking, music, whatever it might be, if I can have a direct relationship with them on the internet, and 1,000 people, let's say, subscribe to me and give me $10 a month, that's 10,000 a month, that's 120,000 a year, right? You can make a good living. And so this, like, I bought into this too. Like, the dream was you'd have this world of, you know, 5 billion people on the internet, and they'd be creating things, and they'd be fine, you know, you'd be sort of matching the creators and the fans, and you'd change the economics of creativity away from mass media, as an example. But that didn't happen because of this consolidation, because these big companies sit in the middle, right? And so well, I don't know, okay, that was not, when you said, like, you know, weren't we involved in the web? Like, that was not part of our, how we imagined it playing out, I guess, when we made, you know, when we got involved with some of those internet companies. We just didn't, I mean, just didn't, it seemed like an unlikely outcome.
Yeah, sort of unintended consequences. That's really interesting. I think to set the stage a little bit, too, I'm not sure how technical the audience is, but the read, write, own title.
Yeah.
Maybe walk us through sort of those stages and what you mean by that.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, so the read, write, own. So read that refers to sort of what I, how I describe in the book, three eras of the internet. Read is sort of the 90s era. Write is sort of roughly the 2000s era. And to read is sort of 1990 to 2005. Write, 2005 to 2020. And then if I'm right, like, I believe this next era can be the own era. The read, write thing is not my terminology. That's common terminology among internet veterans. And I'll explain that. So, generally, when a new medium arises, at first, people kind of copy prior forms of media. So early films, you know, people would just sort of put the camera there and they would film plays, right? And then today, you know, you have like this entire kind of grammar. I just saw Dune 2 this weekend, which is really, really cool. But like, it's a lot different films today with all of the fancy special effects and the close-ups and like everything else than films originally, right? So it takes time though, right, for filmmakers to kind of really understand the true capabilities of the new medium. And similarly with the internet. So the 90s internet that was very much sort of people were taking brochures and catalogs and just kind of putting them on the internet. And it was a very mostly a passive experience where you were consuming information and you didn't have things like social media. And so people called it the read era in the sense that you're mostly, it's like a nerd analogy to file systems, but like read meaning you're reading, you're consuming information. So sort of the 90s internet democratizes the consumption of information. And in the 2000s, there was the internet crash. And that's kind of when I was an entrepreneur. There was a new movement. People called it the read-write movement. They also called it Web 2. And the movement was, what if we can now kind of embrace this, the true capabilities of the internet and democratize not only the consumption of information, but also the publishing of information. And so that was the rise of blogging and then Twitter and Facebook and all these other things, right? And so, in the book, I argue, and I kind of go through in detail and explain it, but I argue that that was kind of there was both good and bad parts of that transition. The good part was the internet got much more powerful. We got broadband, we got video, we got, you know, the internet went from a couple hundred million to computers to 5 billion smartphones. You can get a $10 Android phone now and have mostly free services. Like, there's a lot of great things about the internet, but on the bad side is we got that by kind of using these, you know, essentially consolidating power around these five services, right? And so then the own refers to what I sort of see is, so blockchains are, and this is sort of the second half of the book, blockchains are kind of a foundational, kind of a building material for building new internet services. So you can build social networks or games or financial services, whatever you use on the internet, you can build them with blockchains, with the distinctive feature being the reason it's called own is it enables digital ownership. It enables the users of a service to own things. And so, for example, if you're, for those of you who, you know, if you use social media like Twitter or Facebook, you don't own, you think you own your name, like your handle on the thing and your audience, but you don't own it because the service can remove it. They can change the algorithm. They can, you know, they can make it harder for you to reach your audience. They can change the economics. They can change how they handle your data. They have full control, right? If you contrast that, and this is one of the things I go through in the book, if you contrast that with like people, like a lot of journalists have moved to things like Substack. Substack is an email service where you can have your audience through email. Why do journalists prefer that? Because you have a direct relationship with your audience, and you control that list. And that means that Substack only charges 10%, whereas Facebook and Twitter charge 100% of the money. The economics are much better for you. The control is much better. If Substack messes with you, you can take your email list and leave.
Right.
And so my argument in the book is that sort of the early internet respected sort of digital ownership, like email and the World Wide Web. And if you have a website, you own that website. And that this next era of the internet can kind of bring back that digital ownership, which helps sort of shift power back to users and away from these big centralized services.
I think some of the ideas you talk about are really exciting. I think a lot of people could agree that the big five tech companies having that much consolidated power, probably that.
Yeah.
I think most people would say that, especially with data collection. But how do you undo that? They're so deeply entrenched in our lives. And a lot of people have a hard time picturing how that gets unraveled and how blockchain can accomplish it.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, and it may be like, I think there's sort of two ways to look at it, right? One is that you know, it, as I mentioned earlier, TV, radio, the automobile industry, you can find many, many examples in history where industries, you know, if you look at 1905 Detroit, there were thousands of car companies. And then 40 years later, there's like GM and Ford, right? And so one argument is sort of, I would call it the kind of more pessimistic argument, right? Isn't this the same pattern as you've seen in all these other industries? My counter argument to that is that I think the internet is special in that it's a network based on software. It's not, you know, when you had radio and TV, like those stations actually ended up like owning or having monopolistic control of like physical lines and other sorts of things. The internet is a much more sort of malleable medium in that you can create a service and with the right incentives and design, it can propagate very quickly. Number one, and number two, and I think of the internet as something, maybe it sounds hyperbolic, but I think it's reasonable to think that the internet is as important as something like, you know, the printing press or one of these other kind of massively historically important inventions. And we're 30 years into it, like 30 years into the printing press, you had people like scribes doing, you know, cursive versions of the Bible. And then 100 years later, you know, you had political revolution and all the, you know, Martin Luther and all these other, and then you had novels and, you know, you had 500 years of the evolution of print. And so, you know, I think we're early in the evolution of the internet. I don't know. That's my belief. And that with the right services and incentives and kind of energy that it's possible. I hope it's possible to reinvent it.
I heard a great analogy recently. I mean, talking about some of the centralization and big tech, like TikTok is a great example where people love TikTok and just the user experience is so great. They seem to care more, at least for now, about the user experience and the entertainment factor than owning their data or being able to export their profile. When do you think that shifts, if it does?
Well, so yeah, I would say certainly you're right that like, and in the book I talk about this, like one reason that these corporate owned services beat out these kind of more open systems was the fact that people want simplicity. They want a great user. And I completely agree with that. And I think for any new service to compete, it has to match the kind of the usability and all of that. I would say like with TikTok, like remember TikTok is sort of there's two parties, right? There's the consumer and then there's the creator.
Right.
And the creators, I think like, look, if you talk to people who have built fan bases on TikTok, you can't make money on TikTok. It's not like email where you can make money. And so if you talk to people that like, who are big TikTok influencers and they're like, you know, they're creating body gel and literally, and like perfume and trying to sell at Walmart and sponsorships. And they're doing all of these kinds of basically trying to work around it because these platforms control all the money that flows through and take all the money. So this is like toll keepers that charge 100%. So I think you have to distinguish the consumers. Right. Yeah, you're right. They'll swipe through and use whatever's fun. But the people that make a living, which is a lot of people now on the internet, like you go to TikTok, you're not going for TikTok's content. You're going for the user-generated content. And those people are not getting paid. And I believe that is a vulnerability in these services because they're 100, you know, the top five social networks made $150 billion in revenue last year. And that's money that in a different system, like in a blockchain system or one of the early internet design systems, most of that money would have gone to the creators. And so I think if you can create a new set of services that say, hey, instead of taking 100% of that $150 billion, we'll take 10% and we'll give the rest to you, that you can come up with a compelling offering. So I think, right, like consumers will probably just go where the content is and the user experience is.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other parties here. I mean, like most of these systems, you know, Uber, right? There's riders and there's drivers. And like the drivers care a lot about how these systems are designed and how much money they make. I have a section in the book on the economics of networks. So I just briefly, like, it's a history of the internet. What are blockchains? By the way, everything is written for general readers. There's no technical words used in the book that isn't defined. So I really think it's hopefully is a book that people understand and like, it's not jargon and like, hopefully, and everything's, I tried one of the rewrites of the book, my colleague told me to remove like every adjective and adverb because they were kind of crutch words that like tech people use. And I, you know, instead of you saying some sort of, you know, superlative, I would replace it with like very specific detailed example. So hopefully that comes through. But anyways, in the book, I talk about what blockchains are. And then I go through in detail sort of the economics of networks, the governance of networks, And all these other concepts. And so I think the economics are, I believe that's the weak underbelly of these services, is that they're just taking too much money, and that dam will break at some point, I believe.
That's a great point on the two sides of that. I think that's a good segue into things like micropayments. I think that's something that you could see really taking off. And the idea, I mean, use Spotify as an example in the book, and the idea of splitting up payments in a way that you're paying creators, you're paying artists, and you would see, you know, a certain level of demand for something like that. Talk about micropayments in general, and what are the possibilities on that side?
Well, like, just to make it, people have probably been following the developments in AI as an example, right? And you think about AI, and so you've got this situation where, you now have AI systems that can generate really compelling visuals, text, probably pretty soon movies, music. Now those systems were trained on data that was, human paintings, human pictures, there's now, the New York Times is suing OpenAI, right? And this is going to play out in court. What's the right answer for, do we want a world where human creators are not paid, for their work? I don't want that internet. I don't want that world. So when you say micropayments, like one idea, for example, is that, but at the same time, do you want to, eliminate AI systems and new technology? They seem powerful. They seem useful. They can, they provide a role. So what's like a happy medium? So for example, one idea when you talk about micropayments is to have essentially money kind of cascade. So if an AI system makes money and it was trained on a bunch of data, I think that money should cascade back to the people that created the data that ended up creating that content, right? As an example, and just generally, the internet is very good at kind of like, the internet likes to take content and remix it, and you have systems like this with music, for example, where you pay royalties for using pieces of music and things like this. That's one interesting kind of use for micropayments. Like, there's other interesting ideas where people are, for example, we're investors in a project that's, so right now, maybe this is getting too technical, but right now, to build sort of an AI system, you need massive amounts of capital and compute. So Facebook just spent $10 billion with a B buying GPUs from NVIDIA to train their AI systems. And so, one question that we think about is how do startups compete with that? And so, for example, the one investment we made recently is sort of meanwhile, all these people have computers out there, GPUs they aren't using. And so, there's a startup we're involved with where it's sort of like Airbnb for GPUs. So a bunch of people have GPUs, and then they kind of say, hey, my GPU is available, I'm not playing a game right now. And then somebody else wants to use it. And this lets a startup kind of harness the power, the same kind of scale of GPUs as a big company using micropayments. So it's basically something like micropayments is sort of like very small digital payments. Mm-hmm. It unlocks a whole new interesting range of possible applications that couldn't have been created before.
And so why does that need to be on blockchain? It seems like something Visa could do, or any of these intermediaries. Why would you argue that it needs to be blockchain based?
Well, so specifically with payments, I would say a couple things. One is, so we don't really have a global payment system today. We have lots of little mini networks. So you have your banks and different countries. This is why there's all these payment companies like Stripe and Adyen and et cetera, right? And Visa, is that there's sort of all these little islands and they don't speak the same languages. And then you have these companies that kind of layer on top, and they charge typically 2.5% of the payment. Now, some of that goes back to consumers, but that's sort of a 2.5% tax on top. Why don't we have a global payment system? I would argue it's not a tech problem. It's not that we don't know how to do it. Sending money is sending bits, and we've been sending bits for a long time on the internet. It's really more of a political problem. It's a problem of how do you get all these countries and all these different how do you get JP Morgan and Visa and MasterCard and Bank of America and everybody to agree on some new standard? Everyone wants, JP Morgan has their own thing, Zelle, and someone else has Venmo, and PayPal has this thing. So you really need, how do you get all these people to get together and agree on something? Right. And by the way, Visa and MasterCard, the way they did in the past, those were nonprofits.
And you made that point in the book, which I thought was fascinating.
And then they switched.
Considering what's happening with OpenAI, actually, that was I wrote that down and was like, that's, I don't think a lot of people know that about Visa.
Well, so a lot of the banks feel burned because these were Visa and MasterCard were nonprofits.
Right.
They created them as nonprofit consortiums and then they converted to for-profits and now they take this kind of tax across of it and they feel burned.
Yeah.
And so now like you basically go to, if you went to them and said, hey, I'm going to create a nonprofit or I'm going to create a company yeah. and we're going to be the unified payment system. People have tried this and they're all like, no, we don't want to do that because
yeah.
we don't trust you. We'll keep our own little payment system. So the question is, how do you get all these people to coordinate? And this is what and I talk about this in the book, one of the ways to look at a blockchain is it's a coordination machine. It's a machine that is credibly neutral, that nobody controls, that you set a set of rules and you know, and I like to say instead of, so Google's old motto was don't be evil. And so I like to say with blockchains, instead of don't be evil, it's can't be evil. It's just like baked into the code. It can't change. Here are the rules. If you're a bunch of different parties, like these banks and other people who don't trust each other and are worried that you may flip and become a for-profit thing and extract money, like you can basically build this technology in a blockchain and say, here are the rules and they can never change no matter what we want to do. And so you can trust it. And so it can help sort of solve these kind of coordination problems where a bunch of parties who don't trust each other can work together.
It's kind of the same question as big tech, but it feels like the payment giants, the banks, it took the U.S. so long to even launch FedNow. It feels like payments is an area that's really ripe for disruption, but is so entrenched with interest of banks and payment networks. Yeah. It's a big problem.
I think, though, I don't know how, if people have, maybe I'm going too crypto here for people, but the stable coins, it's really, really interesting, like $600 billion in stable coin volume last month. I was just at an event in the city yesterday and somebody raised their hand and they said, I don't even like crypto. I don't like any of this stuff. But I use stable coins like 40 times a day because I pay people internationally and it's incredibly easy and I can just like, you know, hit a button and do it. And it's, you know, I don't know if you've done an international wire lately. We did one recently from our firm and it was like 2 weeks and like literally you call them up and they're like, we don't know where the money is. I'm like, okay, it's a lot of money. Like, where is it? And so like anyone who's done international payments, like it's not a good system. I mean, because it's literally like this very patchwork thing.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, kind of like, I mean, there are some of the like Swift and other things, but it's like very duct taped together.
It seems like remittances are a huge area where that it's a no brainer. And being able to track dollar amounts that are that large. I wonder just, and this might be, again, a sort of niche crypto question, but do you see that as a Bitcoin solution? What do you think is the best way to solve that?
I think that more and more, so just for people who don't know, stable coins are basically US dollars that run on a blockchain like Ethereum, and it's becoming increasingly popular. And I think hopefully we'll soon have, you know, regulation that kind of really fully legalizes it and puts auditing around it and controls. Which would be great because it's going to like, you know, really make it clearly like the rules of the road will be really clear.
Yeah.
And I think that's clearly kind of the winning thing. It's very very popular in, for example, Argentina, the last stat I saw, 18% of the population has stable coins.
Yeah.
It's like the dollar is a very popular product. It's the US's most popular export. And so making it more accessible and easy to get just turns out to be really popular.
I do want to ask you about regulation. I think that's a great point about emerging markets and some of the use cases for crypto. I think in other countries, it makes a lot more sense if you're really looking for exposure to US dollars. So you talked a little bit about the casino culture. What has that done for crypto moving forward or blockchains for Web3? It seems like there has been this stain on that word because of really Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. Yeah.
No, it's true. The way I kind of think of it is there's the core technology. There's the sort of these speculative casino people. And this range is, this is not like all like fraud and everything. It's just some people just want to gamble and things like that. And then there's sort of the group I'm part of, and it's a sizable group. It's, you know, at least tens of thousands of people work professionally in it. If, you know, they go to these conferences and they have startups, and it's a big group. We're involved with a lot of them. And then there's sort of the you know, the policy kind of stuff. And I think one of the things that we're working a lot on is, and it's a little bit frustrating, is that we think a lot of the current policy approaches inadvertently support the casino and hurt the productive use cases. And so I'll give you an example. If for those who follow the space, there's things called meme coins, which have become increasingly popular. So meme coins are crypto tokens that have by design no purpose. They're just purely for gambling. And those are perfectly legal. Those are perfectly legal. Like Dogecoin is the most prominent one. It's legal. And you go to Robinhood and you go to any, you can go to you know, licensed broker dealers and you can, and like Robinhood, and you can buy Dogecoin. Okay. And then, if you go and you take that token and you try to make something useful, like the things I describe in my book, like a digital asset that is used, you know, as a way to pay creative people for their work in an AI system, that's actually when you run into kind of legal gray area. I won't go into all the details, but there's this thing called the Howey test, is whether you're security, and that actually really favors these meme coins. And that's why Robinhood delisted Solana, but still lists Dogecoin. Okay. It's because, yes. And so we have a situation. Now, I don't think that is some kind of like bad. I think to me, what the lesson is that when you have new technologies, I believe the right way to think about new technologies is to look at the technology holistically, look at the good and the bad, and design policies that maximize the good and minimize the bad. By the way, the same thing in AI, like this lawsuit I mentioned with New York Times and OpenAI, like it really comes down to the question of like, is a machine learning system copying the data that it's used for training, or is it inspired by the data it's used for training? And like, it's like this philosophical question. Yeah. What you're going to have is a 5-year process with judges deciding it and appeals, and it's going to take 10 years. And a judge is finally going to sort of determine that a document written 150 years ago means that this machine learning system was either inspired or copied. Okay. And I'm just saying like, I'm sure there'll be very smart judges and all these other things, but is that the right way for like the United States to decide on how the best path forward with these technologies, or alternatively, what I would suggest is look at the AI system, look at all the interest, like, look, we want to support creative people. We want to embrace new technology. What's the right balance and the right set of policies that would maximize both of those objectives? And similarly, with the reason that part of why I wrote this book is I wanted to say, here's the good side. Okay, we already see all the bad side of blockchains and crypto. That's, you know, you've seen that, you read about that all the time. This is the good side. And I would argue that the right policy approach, instead of it playing out in court and everything else, which is what's happening, would be to sit down and say like, hey, how do we allow some of the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff? Like, we want to get rid of the casino stuff. We think there needs to be, like, I go to DC a lot and we argue this, and people are actually surprised because we think that basically meme coins and these things should have a lot more restrictions. They should have lockups. They should have disclosures. Like the old systems that were set up before the internet don't cover these new use cases. A 12-year-old in a random country can spin up a meme coin that goes viral. Like, that didn't happen 50 years ago with the stock market. You had listing standards and all these other things. Like, now you can do that. You need new rules for a new world.
It is really interesting, and I think this new chapter of the internet too, and you describe this in the book, but it really does rely on this sort of token economy, that it's incentives for people to build things. So you kind of need those currencies. You need not necessarily meme coins, but you need cryptocurrencies to go along with a lot of these projects. It's really core to what you argue for in the book, yet you have this sort of gambling casino culture and people that want to trade. So I don't know how you solve that. How are you approaching
it? Well, I think of it, yeah, that's a great question. I think of it kind of like, so think about like home ownership. So, you know, I think we all would agree that the ability to own a home is important. It's like psychologically, you know, you can raise a family. It's good. There's evidence that people that own homes invest in their homes, they invest in their communities. And I would say the same thing with digital ownership. Like, tokens are the mechanism by which you own things. But like, this idea that people should be able to own things on the internet, own names, own data, own, you know, game items, own, you know, financial assets, whatever it might be. That idea, I think, is important and has a positive benefit. Now, a byproduct, think about home ownership, right, is you have homes, you have people that flip homes, you have people that speculate on real estate. And we kind of, as a society, we accept that because it does provide a role, right? Like, the fact that you can go on Zillow and see a price is due to the fact that there's people trading these things or something, right? I mean, like, it's price discovery, liquidity. There's arguments for why you have markets.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't be the focus, and there should be guardrails around it, right? And I think of the same way with digital ownership. Like, yes, you should, if you truly own something, you should have the right to sell it. And there will be people that like to, you know, speculate, and that just happens. But you need guardrails around it, and it shouldn't be the focus. It shouldn't be the main point. And right now, that's all kind of a lot of people see. They don't see the other side of it.
And you do also talk in the book about the differences between, I guess, where Bitcoin is, where it's hit a threshold where people can agree that it's decentralized and it's, you know, a commodity. And then you have the currency side of things and the SEC really taking a close look.
Yeah.
Gary Gensler seems to be dead set on cryptocurrencies being securities, except for Bitcoin. What is the outcome? And I guess, how would you advise startups who are dealing with that when there's not a lot of clarity, and the clarity that has come from the SEC has been absolutely, you've got to register. You know, these are investment contracts. He's been tough on cryptocurrency.
Yeah. So just to give everyone context, like, so in basically the kind of the simple way to think of it is, in the world, there's things like gold, which are classified legally as commodities. And then there are securities, which is like the Apple stock. And the main difference is, with a security, there's sort of a group of people like the Apple management team who know something about like the future earnings of the company that is material to the price of that stock. And therefore, what the role of regulators in that case around securities is to make sure it's a level playing field, make sure that there's insider trading rules, there's disclosure rules. Those rules do not apply to things like gold. So gold is just, even though there's people that are probably experts on gold and study gold, the kind of the legal theory is gold is, you know, is decentralized enough. There's just enough, you know, there's no sort of company that controls it or something, that you need a different regulatory regime around it. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the with Bitcoin, sort of, it's been deemed by regulators to be more like gold than like Apple stock, right? But now, of course, you know, Bitcoin was created by one person, or we think by one person, or some shadowy group of people, pseudonymous white paper. But like everything in the world, started off as a person's idea and probably someone sitting in a room, and that's centralized. And so there's a pathway. You go from being centralized to decentralized, right? It's not like gold that, you know, was created in whatever, some physical process. Like, these are ideas, and they have to fall. And so what we believe is that there should be some kind of path with guardrails where somebody can invent something new and eventually achieve that regulatory status that Bitcoin has today. That's our argument. It's not that it should be a free for all. In fact, we very much think there should be guardrails around it, but like, why? Because otherwise you're just arbitrarily saying something from 15 years ago is okay, but nothing new could be created. Right. I mean, that just seems like kind of arbitrary and anti, you know, new innovation, right? Like, if you believe, as I do, this is an important new kind of computing architecture, like, why should we sort of stop all innovation in 2009?
How do you guys think about investing in firms when it's either tokens or equity or both? I think, for those who don't know, I mean, some of these cryptocurrencies are a way for the average person to invest, but also venture firms might want to get an allocation through tokens. Is there a risk that by investing in the tokens, you're making it more centralized, or you're having too much ownership in what is supposed to really be, as you're saying, decentralized and transparent and all of that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Maybe if I could just briefly, like, so we do venture capital. So you may, just to clarify, like, there are, there's a big difference between sort of venture, what we do, and sort of trading and hedge funds. So what we do is we raise money and we have 10-year funds, which means, and then we go and our typical business is that, like, a small group of people, you know, of technologists, often 1 to 3 people, come to us. They have an idea. We give them money. We give them help. And we expect to wait many, many years before we have any kind of financial return. So it's very different. And we do this in the blockchain space as well. So we're not, like, kind of trading and, you know, I don't know what, like, Bloomberg screens and all that stuff. Like, we're much more like, you know, it's like investing and helping. Yeah. And then the way it works is that sometimes those people end up creating something kind of like Bitcoin, where they have a token. And in that case, that we have some sort of pro rata share according to our investment. And other times they'll create, like, we're investors in Coinbase, just like a more kind of traditional company, and we own part of that. And then, so it varies. But the key kind of common thread is we're very long-term, and we're very much like kind of partnering with the entrepreneurs, and we're very focused on real innovation and creating products that are used by tens and hopefully hundreds of millions of people.
Do you think that will change venture capital going forward? Do you think that economic model will take off, you know, in other parts of Andreessen Horowitz and the venture community?
I think if what we're doing works, I hope that it transforms the internet, and we have an internet that's sort of dominated by community owned and operated services instead of these corporate owned services. And that it kind of creates a renaissance of innovation. And yeah, and I think, if that, in the big dream and the sort of thing I describe in the end of the book, if that were to pass, I think that would also, you know, I think of it as sort of investors and the financial markets follow innovation. Mm-hmm. And so if that's where innovation goes, I expect that would change the way people invest as well.
You do talk a bit about AI in the book. And I thought it was really interesting, the evolution from, I guess, the Turing test. And I think you argue it took, what, 80 years from that era to really get to the ChatGPT moment. What's holding back Web3 from having its iPhone or ChatGPT moment?
Yeah, so the dominant architecture of modern AI that's been so powerful and people have seen with ChatGPT is based on neural networks. The first neural network paper was 1943. There's a long history of people working on AI. There was an AI financial bubble in the 1980s. If people talk to veterans, they'll talk about summers and winters. I started an AI company in 2008 that was acquired by eBay. I thought it was the right time. I was too early. It's hard to get the timing right in these things. It's been around for a long time. And it's really interesting with AI. Like, why did it end up working now? Like, a lot of it is these chips called GPUs that made by companies like NVIDIA. Why did those chips get so good? Video games. So, like, because basically NVIDIA was a video game hardware provider up until recently. So if we ever have, like, advanced artificial intelligence running the world, it all kind of originated with Fortnite and other video games, which is kind of an interesting historical fact. I talk about in the book, I think there's sort of common patterns with computing waves. So, you had early computers in World War II, you had mainframe computers, you had mini computers, you had PCs, you had the internet, you had smartphones, you have AI now. And I think there's kind of predictable patterns that I walk through in the book where there's sort of this early incubation phase where there's sort of tinkerers and hobbyists and enthusiasts playing around with it, maybe researchers. And then over time, what happens is it's kind of like with the AI stuff, like eventually the infrastructure gets good enough. Mm-hmm. Like the big thing with AI right now is just the chip. I mean, there's a lot of smart people, and I don't want to take anything away from all the innovation, but a lot of it comes down to the chips. You can just run much, much bigger neural networks because the chips are just much, much better. And so a lot of it, I think, comes down to the infrastructure. And the infrastructure in the blockchain world has gotten much, much better. I don't know, I'm optimistic that we're kind of getting close to a point where we can have really mainstream applications that take advantage of that infrastructure. But as I said, I started an AI company in 2008, so like I have been early at times. So I don't know. So it's very hard to predict sometimes the timing of these things because it's complicated. There's tech, there's people, there's companies, there's regulation. There's just, the world is complicated. There's many factors. Like, when does it all come together and to the right product that really kind of, that excites people and all the pieces are there. And so I think that we're kind of in the near, like in the next year, couple of years, but I hope.
So it's the blockchains themselves. It's the underlying block, I guess. You can describe it.
Yeah. So like Ethereum is this sort of, so what happened, the brief history, there was this white paper in 2009 by this pseudonymous individual that first described Bitcoin. And then there was sort of the big kind of next major kind of development was the invention of Ethereum, which sort of, think of it as kind of like the BlackBerry was a phone where you could only do kind of one thing. You could email, and then the iPhone came out and it had an app store and anyone could write an application for it. And that's kind of roughly analogous. So Bitcoin is a specific thing. It's a financial service. You may or may not believe in it. Digital gold, it has all sorts of people. I think most people have an opinion. They either love it or hate it. It's totally separate. There's Ethereum is just sort of generalized that idea. So it's a general purpose computer. Anyone can write applications for it. But until recently, it was like, if you just did a simple thing, like you want to do a transaction, it cost $10, $20. Like, it's very, very expensive. And that what that meant was it was limited primarily to these sort of high dollar value financial things where you're willing to pay $20. You now have, these, I won't go into the details, but like what are called layer twos and these other systems, which you now have like a credible, like kind of penny, sub penny kind of transaction fees. For a lot, we'll see if, it's a lot of it depends on supply and demand and it's complicated, but it seems like there's been a very multiple orders of magnitude sort of improvement there. The security's gotten better, the performance gotten better. So just sort of all the things, just like with a regular computer, they get faster, they get better, they get cheaper. It's a similar kind of curve it's followed, and that as the computer kind of gets better and faster and cheaper, you can just do a lot more things.
What about energy consumption? We have a question here as well. We'll start taking audience questions shortly, but there's a good question here about energy consumption. Does that improve over time?
Thank you for asking that. And I go through this in the book if you're interested. But that, so just the, I'll give you the summary, which is that is basically Bitcoin specific at this point, and none of the other systems that we work on there have that. The system we work on is a different system. It's called proof of stake, not proof of work. Ethereum and all of the other blockchains that we're involved with, they have energy consumption that's much more comparable to a traditional kind of web service. And I have a chart in the book, which actually Darren right here did tons of research and is well documented. And so anyway, so that's, but, and I'll just explain very briefly is that, well, maybe, I don't know if I want to go into details, but essentially like there, it was originally this sort of like Bitcoin was designed. The idea with Bitcoin was it wanted to be a system where anyone could join the system. And so it was sort of this anti-elitist idea that anyone could add a computer to the network. But the problem that the designer of Satoshi had was if anyone can add a computer to the network, what prevents somebody from adding 1,000 computers and spamming the system? And so the idea was to have sort of a price of admission. And that price of admission was literally you have to waste energy on your computer, which seemed okay when Bitcoin was small and it was like a relatively small amount. And it was a clever way to sort of solve this. It's a price to admit, sort of like a ticket to participate that avoids the system getting spammed, but also isn't elitist. That was sort of the original. So it was a really kind of cool original idea. The problem is Bitcoin got so big and the energy consumption got so big. And so like Ethereum used to be proof of work, but switched to proof of stake. Proof of stake is very different. The price of admission, you don't waste energy. You just have to put a little bit of money in collateral that you can lose if you are dishonest and spam the system. And so there's just, you just remove that whole element from the system. So I really, now the Bitcoiners are religious about proof of work. They will never change. I don't agree with them. I think they should change. But all of the other systems that we talk about and all the ones that we're involved with are this proof of stake, and the energy consumption is comparable to, YouTube and every other thing you use. So I don't think that that's a fair critique of the kind of the stuff that we're involved with.
Beyond Bitcoin. You talked a bit about the blockchains needing to be improved, but also, you know, the people that are working on these. Do you feel like AI is taking any of the shine off of, you know, young engineering talent that might be attracted to go work at an AI startup instead of blockchain or Web3?
Yeah, I have heard the word LLM more in the last 2 days than I had in the last 6 months. I used to live here, and I don't live in the Bay Area. But both the strength and weakness of the Bay Area, it's mostly a strength. I mean, it's incredibly, you know, obviously wildly successful area where so much invention has come from, and I'm a big fan. But you know, it's sort of this. It's like I call it kid soccer. You know, kid soccer where you have like all 22 people are like right around the ball, right? So, whereas like professional soccer, you stay. So like Silicon Valley, both the strength and weakness is like a new thing comes out and like everybody does it, right? And that's, you know, what it comes out of it is Google and Facebook and just like all of these, you know, whatever, iPhone.
They're the worst.
Yeah.
We don't...
No, but I mean, like, I'm sure I don't work in Hollywood, but I assume it's the same thing. Like everyone makes a superhero movie. Everyone makes this, you know, but out of that, hopefully you get like a couple of great things, you know, and it's sort of this traffic jam, and then you get some greatness out of it. I think that's happened to some extent recently. Like, I think we had sort of a double bad thing. We had the FTX stuff, and then, you know, not the AI stuff was good, but then, yeah, that was sort of this outlet to this other area. But I would say one thing, like, the blockchain movement is very global. Most of these projects have come from, like, other countries, and that's remained very strong. And I think, you know, we just see kind of more and more, sort of steady growing kind of developer community. And I think these things are just kind of pendulums that swing back and forth. I think that as the sort of the new wave of applications get built and people get inspired, it just takes a couple of interesting applications and people get excited. And so I think that, we're seeing a lot of really talented people working in the space. And but I think ultimately people get excited by products. And so we need to have kind of more products that people see and get excited about to really kind of galvanize the community.
What do you think the products in the near term are that will get people excited, get consumers excited? Like we talked about in that TikTok example, to the point where they might not realize, you know, they're using a blockchain application. If there were an iPhone ChatGPT moment for Web3, you could make a call. What do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting things happening. So, like I talked about social networking, and there's one that we're involved with called Farcaster that's interesting and growing, which is a social networking community where the big difference is that the users control their name and their audience. And so instead of sort of being stuck, this is what we were talking about earlier with TikTok, you're not stuck with TikTok. You can switch software providers, you can take your audience, move it around. And we're just seeing, like, I just, you know, and that also means software developers can come and like you can basically build internet services kind of as Lego bricks, where people one person builds one piece and somebody else builds another piece. I think that whole kind of area. I mean, look, people spend 7 hours a day on the internet and 2.5 hours is social networking. So like you can't, I know it's a lot. You can't, you know, if you want to build a new wave of internet services, like you have to take social networking seriously. Games are a very popular category, and there's a lot of interesting things happening where they're games where instead of sort of like the most popular way that games make money today is they sell, I don't know how much gamers are here, but they sell virtual goods. They sell, you play Fortnite and you buy like an outfit or a dance move. But all that money goes to the company behind it. And so people are creating games where it's much more of a kind of a peer-to-peer economy. It's kind of created by a community. So that's exciting. Some of the AI stuff I mentioned, there's, you know, one of the things we're going to see soon is a proliferation of deepfakes. And so it's now very easy to create video and audio that where you, you know, it looks like a politician is saying something. It's very easy to replicate somebody's voice. It's very easy to write, you know, an email that looks very convincing with AI. What we need, I think, to counter that are really good systems for, you know, answering the question, is this a real person? Is this video authentic? A blockchain is basically a very, very good kind of community-owned database for proving that somebody's real, that a piece of video has a certain provenance. So we're seeing a lot of stuff sort of, I would say, you know, to sort of counterbalance AI. So AI in its centralizing way and also just its ability to create all of this kind of content. You can use blockchains as kind of a source of truth that helps you sift through that content and understand what's real and who's real.
The deepfake conversation is fascinating. We'll take some of these questions. There's some great ones in here. Is there anything you've seen so far that just hasn't worked that you've said, all right, this does not seem to be a Web3 technology. It's better on Web2. It's been a flop. It just hasn't worked.
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, like a lot, I mean, in the business I'm in, you know, we're in this business of investing in early stage innovation. And like, look, it's just the nature of the business is a lot of stuff doesn't work. And that's not unique to blockchains. That's just generally like, it's like, I think it's probably true of any projects that involve groups of people. Like people get in fights, the products don't work. You know, there's just a million things that can go wrong. And so certainly I've been involved with things that haven't worked. I kind of think of software as a very, like I was mentioning before, as like a very malleable medium with a very rich design space. I kind of think of it as, in some ways, I think of it as analogous to like writing English, like writing novels or something. Like to me, saying there'll never be a software product that does X, Y, and Z is almost like saying, you know, there'll never be a great novel in this genre or something. Like if some really creative person comes along and has a great idea and builds the right product, at least that's how I try to approach it. I try to approach it more like we're like book publishers looking for really talented people working in a rich design space, as opposed to like, this is a good or bad category. So does that make sense? Like,
yeah, that's a good analogy. There's some really good, someone's asking, how do you do your crypto taxes?
Which is, oh my God, it's a
relevant question.
It's a very specific question.
It's very specific.
It's like a nightmare.
I know. That is kind of a headache.
There's all the software like Coin Tracker or something, but yeah. It's still like a nightmare. And then if you're an RIA, I don't know if you want to know what this is, you have compliance and you have all this other stuff, but it's not easy. I don't know.
That's my favorite question so far. There's some really good ones. I think we've answered some of these. Actually, when you were talking about Bitcoin, there seems to be these sort of warring factions. I don't know if you felt this way in the early internet, and if this was the case, tell us, because I think it's fascinating. But kind of the cultural differences between the Bitcoiners and people who back Ethereum and these other projects. What's going on there? Like, why is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's like massive tribal.
Yeah. What is that about?
That's the thing is, like, people see I'm into like crypto. They think I'm like a Bitcoiner and like proof of work and like all this other stuff. But actually, there's like, it's the tyranny of small differences, they call it. It's like, you know, the two people with the most similarities end up hating each other the most or something. There's very much. Look, I mean, I think a lot of people that are into Bitcoin come to it from kind of libertarian politics, essentially. Mm-hmm. They see it as digital gold and a sort of anti-government thing. And I think that has, I believe that has unfairly colored the whole category as being kind of libertarian or right wing or something, which I don't think, I think that if anything, if you look at the Ethereum, I mean, I think it's politically neutral, I would say, but I think probably a lot of, like a lot of the tech world, people actually probably, I don't do a poll or anything, but I think they probably skew left in the, like the Ethereum world. But so, yeah, so it's very different. So they're concerned. Most people that are into Bitcoin are mostly concerned with big government, inflation. They're fans of Milton Friedman, Hayek, like that's kind of genre, right? Yes. Most people that are into Ethereum are, I think, are more in my school, we're concerned about big tech, right? So it's a different set of concerns. Mm-hmm. Like I have no opinion on the, I have an opinion, but it's not worth sharing. It's like inflation or whatever. I'm just like a person who, you know, doesn't know much about it. So I don't like have a strong opinion because it's not my area.
Yeah.
And that's not why I'm in this space. Right. So it's just a very different set of motivations, but then, and then the rivalry is that folks like you go on TV and then you talk about Bitcoin and or you got to talk about Ethereum and then the Bitcoiners get mad. They're like, why are they getting the spotlight? Why? Right. And so they want all the attention and they see it as like taking away from their attention. And then, you know, now there's Solana and that's taking their attention. And so they're, you know, it's like anything where they're kind of arguing for attention and they have a different ideology and, I don't know. It's like, and then it just becomes kind of silly and they have memes and they attack us on Twitter. And
it's like a sociology project. It's fascinating to me. I feel like that's a whole nother conversation. This is a great question about your research for this book. Was there anything that surprised or shocked you? And I guess what was maybe the most shocking thing you learned through writing this?
That's a good question. I mean, I lived like, well, at least I go back to the before the part I lived, like in the, like the internet, the ARPANET was 69, but I lived through the late 90s or was actively involved late 90s, 2000. So I was sort of in it. So I did research and I hired a research assistant, to fact check me essentially. And I did make a few like dates, mistakes and things, but I basically lived through most of the internet, that part. So I kind of knew it. I would say, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's interesting because like there aren't many histories of the internet as I was writing it. Yeah. That was part of it. Like I actually had to go, and actually, sadly, the internet itself, it's hard to get old articles. So I actually had to go to a lot of stuff is like literally just in the library. Like you have to go and like go find old magazines and things.
What library were you hanging out at?
This is my research assistant did that. So there just aren't that many kind of histories. There's a few good books, but they're more kind of just like here. Like there's a good book called The Internet from Netscape to the iPhone, I think it's called. And there's a few that sort of goes through each company and the history of it, but there aren't a lot. There's Katie Hafner has a book on like ARPANET and the early internet. But my history is through the lens of kind of how does power and money work and like how did the internet go from this open decentralized system to this consolidated system? I don't think that anyone else has done it. If someone else has, I'd love to see it. Oh, there's others like Tim Wu is the master switch. So there are some interesting ones, but I thought no one had kind of done it from this lens. And so really, honestly, a lot of it was just my own experience and then checking it and making sure I got it right through kind of this research help I had.
That's something I took away. I think some of the early internet history I thought was really fascinating. In this book, not something I necessarily expected going into it thinking Web3. This is a great question. What are your thoughts on other initiatives that are aiming for a better web but are not related to blockchain? And how can we take advantage of our common efforts?
Yeah, so I do talk about this in the book, and there's a bunch of people who I describe them as kind of trying to bring back the protocols or protocol networks, which is sort of the architecture of the early web of the World Wide Web of email, HTTP, SMTP. And so like Tim Berners-Lee himself has this thing called the semantic web. And there's a whole bunch. I list a bunch in the book, but there's hundreds of some of the modern ones like Mastodon, this thing called the Fediverse. And I'm fans of them all. And if they work, that's great. Because I think that would be great if we could create new social networks that weren't owned by companies, and I would support them. It's been 30 years of people trying to do that. And I was involved with a bunch of these things including RSS, which is sort of the most prominent example. And it just hasn't worked. And so my view is, like, I share those goals. If they work, I'd be behind them. But let's try another approach to the same solution with a different set of technologies is kind of my argument. But I do think that, like, I think those missions, this is like the Fediverse, it's sort of this loose, you know, it's, if you Mastodon, Blue Sky, I don't know, people know it. It's, I think it's interesting. I think it's good work they're doing. I think, like, and I go through specifically in the book why I think they have challenges. One of them is you're competing with, so I give this case study of YouTube, so how, and how YouTube grew. And it grew very much through subsidization. So YouTube, all of these internet services, these companies heavily, heavily subsidize the services and pay for hosting fees and all sorts of other things. And that's why Twitter, Facebook, YouTube raised, you know, billions of dollars of venture capital. And I know this from working in the venture capital industry. They raise this money, they subsidize all these services. And it's very, very hard for kind of these ragtag groups of developers who don't have any resources to compete with that. One of the interesting things with blockchains is that they're community-owned, like these protocols, but they actually have a funding mechanism. These are the tokens, and they can do things like subsidization. So my kind of core argument in the book is that they have the benefits of these older systems like protocol networks, but they can actually now compete on a level playing field with these heavily funded corporate systems. Like, that's kind of, the, in a way, the kind of the, yeah, the core thesis.
That's a great one. This question, we've got 4 or 5 minutes left, is about identity, which is another interesting use case you talk about a little bit in the book. But payments and identity specifically, but I do think it's worth talking about, like, ownership of identity and what that might look like in blockchain.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think it's a very important missing thing on the internet is this, is sort of having a, having an identity that you own. In some ways, in the, you know, I think a lot of tech people overlook this because tech people like me, like, I have a domain, I have cdixon.org, I have, like, my own email address, I have a website. And I think tech people sometimes think that that's sort of like solved that problem, but it's not a mainstream thing. If you walk down the street in San Francisco, maybe San Francisco is an exception, but anywhere else in the world, and you ask people if they have a domain, they, most of them don't. Like, they just don't see the purpose of it. Like, they don't have a digital identity, and that's why, and they don't have a way to prove their real, the closest thing they have is like their Facebook identity or something, right? And then you have these ridiculous things like the CAPTCHAs, where you have to click on how many traffic lights because there's no system for proving you're a person. There's no real identity system.
Backs me up every time.
Yeah. And so, like, there should be, like, and look, and one way to do it would be, and this is actually, there's some interesting proposals to do this, would be a government issued digital identity. That's one way to do it. Another would be a kind of a, you know, a more kind of like what I argue is like a blockchain based kind of approach. But I do think it's a really, really critical thing that we're missing. And I think particularly when I mentioned AI, like, how are you going to know that this email really came from your friend? You know, they can spoof the header, they can spoof the text. Like, you know, and we have the technology to do it, which is cryptography, which is you can sign a message that proves that if you, you know, if you are this person, you can sign this and you can see verification. That's what those little check marks in the browser are, the website signing something. And now we need a way for people to sign things. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a critical missing thing. And what I worry about is if it's not created as a public good, either by the government or through a blockchain based solution, which is how I argue the book, the two ways to kind of do it, mm-hmm. it will be created as a private good. Like, Facebook will do it or Google will do it. And then they'll do all the little shenanigans that they do now and, like, you know, and figure out a way to make money out of it.
Do you worry now with how involved these companies are in the large language models and in AI that the history will repeat itself and big tech is going to become really controlling the next wave of the internet?
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, this is not, I mean... So, like, for those who read kind of tech business stuff, like Clay Christensen, you know, who invented the sort of phrase disruptive technology, he talks about how there's two types of technologies. There's disruptive, which, and there's sustaining, he says. And disruptive, that word gets thrown around a lot, but what he meant something fairly technical, which is it's a new technology that is fundamentally misaligned with the business models of the incumbents. And so, like, people get this history wrong, like, Sears, you know, kind of went out, it's basically gone out of business and replaced by Amazon and Walmart. Mm-hmm. Sears owned Prodigy or CompuServe. I forget. They owned one of the top three internet services in the 1980s. They saw this coming from a decade away. Okay. Barnes & Noble was smart and they built like a really good website. Like those internet companies that got disrupted, Blockbuster, et cetera, they were smart executives.
Right.
The problem was, like, Barnes & Noble would have had to shut down all of their stores and build robotic factories and completely shift their business. That's what disruptive means. Disruptive means a new thing comes along, and unless the incumbents throw out everything they've already learned, they can't match it. Okay. AI, I would argue, is sustaining in the sense that they don't need to throw away everything. They already have all these AI people. They already have people coming to search. They can now overlay, instead of typing in a word, you ask a question, mm-hmm. right? They can put their ads on the side. I would argue it's sustaining. And when you have sustaining technologies in general, most of the kind of the economic benefits end up flowing to those incumbents. And so that's a really interesting question is my concern is that with AI, I'm pro AI, I like AI, I'm not anti AI, but I do think that there's a real concern that it will further exacerbate the consolidation, you know, further consolidate the internet. And, you know, and we could end up with just sort of basically three websites, and you go to this one of those three and you ask a question, you get an answer, you get an image, you get this, and that's like, that's the internet. Like, because why would you need to go anywhere else? Because you get it tells you what restaurant to go to, it gives you a photo, it gives you the text. And like, is that the internet we want? Don't we want an internet of like 5 billion people all kind of participating and joining and creating and sharing? And I think it's, to me, that's a much brighter future. And I don't know. So that's my concern with where we're headed right now. Look, it's still early and we can change the direction. And I think it's just time. Now is the time to think about that. Like, what kind of internet do we want? And do we want it controlled by a few companies, or do we want it, you know, more decentralized?
It's fascinating. I think we're out of time. There's a ton of questions in here about regulation. Final thoughts on what could happen in DC that would shape this industry in a positive way. I think there's been so much talk about clarity.
Yeah.
What does that look like? And what are your efforts in Washington? What's your end goal here?
Yeah, I think, well, it's a little bit like what I was talking about before, which is, I just think just like a sense of like kind of an approach that says, looks at the technology holistically. I think AI is also, you know, another kind of hotbed area, flashpoint. Look at the technology holistically and design like a reasonable set of policies and like the specific mechanism. It can happen at the executive branch under a regulatory agency. It can happen through legislation. Mm-hmm. It's right now happening in the courts.
The courts.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I think the courts is not the right way because it takes many years. Right. It's uncertain. Like, and so we'll see how it plays out. Like, I'm optimistic. I'm hoping that as kind of people understand the full possibilities of the technology and that there are good things in addition to the bad things, that we'll come up with like a sensible compromise. And I think that will be where we end up.
How do you rebuild trust? I mean, we talked so much about the casino culture, but it feels like this technology is so promising, but then you still have, you know, people that are running it, people who are running exchanges and startups. Are you doing anything will that just happen over time? Or how will people know that they can, you know, safely invest or trust some of these projects, even if the tech is sound, being able to trust?
Well, there are differences. Like Coinbase is a public company in the US. It's audited, it's regulated by the US. Like, it's like, you know, like the money you have there is all, you know, backed by banks and auditors and everything else. And some things like FTX was offshore, not audited. So there are differences. And I think this kind of cleansing, this is what happened. There were a lot of bad things, a lot of people hurt, but it also got rid of a lot of bad actors. It led to a settlement with Binance, which was the other kind of one that was question mark. And I think I think a lot of stuff has been cleaned up. And then I think over time, what needs to happen, hopefully the regulators do that and kind of make sure that they're, you know, guardrails and things are cleaned up. And then ultimately, I think the way you rebuild trust is you build products that people love and use and see the value of. And that's on us, like me and the people I work with, to do that. And I think that ultimately is what will show people that there's value.
Bitcoin just hit an all-time high. So it seems like at least that shakeout has it's been reflected in the markets. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you,
everyone, for the amazing questions. Really fun. All right, guys, we'll see you soon.
Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.